Everyone talks big yields, but Channel Seedsmen deliver advice that yields results. Every season, Channel Seedsmen match elite seed products with unmatched service and support to push the performance of every acre. That's why you can count on Channel for what you need to make the most of your season. You don't have to be a Channel customer to take advantage of this support. Visit channel.com/agritalk to sign up and receive expert advice that yields.
Welcome to Friday DC Signal to Noise, a packed show coming up today. We're going to talk a little bit about USMCA going into a full effect this week. Jim Wiesmeyer has a big signal on China for us to watch for in the coming weeks. We're going to get that. We're going to talk about today's unemployment report. We're going to talk about the work to fighting a deadline to get a new aid package, COVID aid package. Sure, we're going to talk about news this week on EPA and I guess putting a hold on some of these gap waiver requests. We're going to get to all of that today on DC Signal to Noise with our prognosticator of signal and noise, Jim Wiesmeyer from Pro Farmer, and Annalisa Laca, who is the dairy editor for Farm Journal and also policy writer for agweb.com. Let's get right into it once again. First, with USMCA, Annalisa, very welcome news for your dairy producers that USMCA went into effect this week.
Yeah, so USMCA went into effect yesterday on July 1st, and dairy producers are thrilled, obviously. There are some things that we need to continue to watch, as Canada, I think we mentioned last week, has proposed some tariff rate quotas that will kind of undermine some of the access that U.S. dairy has into Canadian markets through USMCA, so we're looking for some more enforcement there. And then just also looking to make sure that Mexico upholds the generic cheese names and the provisions that are within USMCA to ensure that, because there are a lot of products that we make and ship to Mexico that fall into that category.
Yeah, and Jim, this is really welcome news across agriculture. Although, how big is the impact of this going to be, especially when you compare it to NAFTA that we already had in place?
Well, the biggest thing is we have certainty that now we're going to have a continuous North American market. Remember, it wasn't too long ago that we were afraid of even losing NAFTA with Trump's threats to to disband that, and we went on a roller coaster ride all through the negotiations on the USMCA. So certainty is definitely a big plus. It's going to take a while for some of the provisions to be implemented. And, like Anna said, this is only the second day of it. The initial issues will be enforcement. U.S. Trade Rep Bob Lighthizer has already announced advisory panel members to make sure on Mexico's labor provisions. On the Canada side, I think they're really going to be persnickety relative to, the dairy provisions and making sure Canada follows through in good faith. I will add, John, that on July the 8th, Mexico's president will be in the Oval Office with President Trump, and they're trying to get Justin Trudeau, Canada's prime minister, to come along. Sean Haney told us on AgriTalk that's still a up in the air issue.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, would be a big symbolic meeting to have the three of them there at the White House next week. And I guess really the signal we watch for in this, Jim, is that really nothing bad happens. Is that what we watch for signal in implementation?
That's actually a good way to put it nowadays. The good is, nothing bad. I would look for, the Democrats are already raising concerns on these, on the, Mexican labor front, and Colin Peterson and others are watching Canada's dairy. But, I really want to stress the signal that I get here from reasonable people is, let's let this breathe a little bit and don't be too negative right away. Give it time and have the countries talk to each other if there are issues. And that's a result of some of the dispute resolution language that's embodied in the USMCA language, which I think, by the way, is another good plus.
Well, another good plus is probably the fact that this version, as opposed to NAFTA, does require coming back and revisiting it. One of the problems with NAFTA was, it became outdated and it failed to address a lot of the issues that were really front and center between the three countries.
Well, you with kids would know that if you had a 24-year-old kid and you don't have any changes, they need them. So, yeah, I think that there is a built-in mechanism that totally makes sense to make it a living, you know, trilateral, you know, trade agreement. So far, so good.
All right. Well, we can't say the same for China this week. We've been talking about this back and forth the last several weeks. Some more animosity ramping up between the two countries, in particular, China voting to approve new restrictions on Hong Kong, really taking away any sort of semblance of sovereignty that Hong Kong had. The U.S. had been treating this, Jim, as a somewhat of a line in the sand, but as yet hasn't taken any dramatic action. What happens next in this back and forth?
Well, you know, as a former beat reporter and now more of an analyst, you can feel this issue accelerating, John. The signals that we're getting for this is China is being very aggressive, not just with the U.S., but around the world relative to their geopolitical relations with Australia, Canada, India, et cetera. So, you know, the signal is it doesn't look good for the short term. What this means for the phase one trade agreement, that's the big sector for agriculture, remains to be seen. I know President Trump really wants to keep that, and for obvious reasons. That's one of the signature issues of his first term. So it will be very curious to see if this tit for tat sanctions keep going on. I think that they will in the short term.
Well, and I think there's a bit of exposure here for China that isn't getting talked about enough. It's getting talked about some, but Hong Kong is, I'll compare it to the mob having a legitimate business. It provides an opening for them. Hong Kong was a legitimate link for China to the rest of the financial world, and now they're putting that in jeopardy. What kind of problem does that create for U.S. agriculture in them doing that?
Well, I think it could create some because Hong Kong, as you said, was a almost like a belt where your buckle serves as a key ingredient to a belt. That's loosening up quite a bit, John. And there was always, you know, two nations, and Hong Kong was always treated differently. And now we're constraining them on some of the trade, benefits that they had, you know, with the United States. And China's flexing its muscles. There's no doubt about it. You saw it in the protests this week of how they buckled down. They're not going to rescind whatsoever. They're going to control Hong Kong as we knew it. Now, the biggest signals that I'm looking for is how this will impact the former financial might of Hong Kong. And that's still playing out. The initial knee-jerk reaction was this would dramatically impact Hong Kong as a financial area. But the veterans that we talk with, the pro-farmer in China and elsewhere, say, let's give this some time to see, you know, whether or not they can keep some of their financial ability in international relations.
All right, Jim, while you're talking signals, so far, neither side has really escalated this as far as the phase one trade agreement is concerned. Both sides this week have been focusing on Hong Kong and not really talking as much about the trade agreement and trying to wrap that into this. But you say there is a significant signal that we should watch for, that if it happens, it means that phase one is in real trouble.
Yes. And one of our China watchers said, you know, told us the key to know when China-U.S. relations have reached a new negative stage is if and when, now that's critical, if and when China's Communist Party media, you know, their controlled media, starts attacking President Trump. Now, they attack Secretary of State Mike Pompeo all the time, but they have not really attacked Trump all that much. And he said that's when the U.S.-China relationship has really gone off the rails, if that were to occur. So that's a signal that hopefully we will not see.
But if that's true, that's a pretty strong signal that the Chinese government really understands this president.
Absolutely. All they understand him. They understand him. That's why you see like at arm's length of complimenting him, because they know Trump loves compliments, and that's why Trump has complimented the China leader Xi Jinping. So far it's on they're not best friends forever. Larry Kudlow, the National Economic Council advisor, today just said again that they're very upset, they're very unhappy, was the exact quote, with China. And that's relative to a host of issues that we've already talked about. Hong Kong, the Uyghurs, or whatever they call it in China, the human rights abuses in that area of China, etc. So, and you saw this week the tit for tat in the media kerfuffle continues, where China issued a new determination, to designate three or four new U.S. media to really justify themselves, and that's on the sidelines of this. But China is big for tit for tat. The signals is they don't let any announced sanctions or negative go uncommented on.
Annalisa, is this resonating at all right now out in farm country?
I don't know. I think that there's still a lot of optimism that particularly with the recent buys from China, that phase one will, be completed within the calendar year. I think there is some skepticism about it. But, I also think when you look at historical trends, right, China does the majority of their purchasing, particularly of soybeans, from now until the end of summer, first of the year. So I don't think that there's a ton of concern about purchases that haven't happened, particularly of soybeans prior to now. But I do think that farmers are anxious to see those soybeans not only on boats, but unloaded in ports in China.
Yeah, which to that point, if we don't see soybeans on boats in September, October, then the concern greatly rises, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. From October to November, history shows they purchase 70% of their total purchases from the U.S. in the ag sector. So, again, if China starts really buying with gusto, and I'm talking about a significant increase from what they've already bought, that will put further pressure on Trump and the U.S. to maybe cool it down, because there would be a price to pay. I do want to comment on a number of farmers who either called me or emailed me the last 2 weeks asking if things continued to go south relative to U.S.-China relations, and this didn't get into phase one, would there be another MFP payment, John? So they're already talking about that from a fear angle.
All right, well, let's continue talking about payments and getting into, clock is ticking on a new COVID-19 relief package. Before we get into that, though, let's talk about the existing package. And Annalisa Laca, you and I were talking earlier today. You said that you're surprised at how few dairy producers are applying for CFAP.
So to be clear, we're not exactly sure how many producers have applied. We know that roughly 17,000 dairy farmers have been paid, and that's of the 34,000 dairy farmers in the United States today. So just, right around half, maybe. I'm not great at math, so somewhere in the neighborhood of half of producers have been paid. And so I've been starting to get questions from farmers that are seeing these numbers and saying, what's going on here? Why haven't more people applied? And that makes me start to wonder, have they applied? Have they not applied? Are we starting to see some backup in the FSA system? I know personally we applied for CFAP like June 6th, and our application had still not been fully processed.
Well, as of the latest report, I looked, and dairy producers have received just over $1 billion, or 22% of total CFAP direct payments. Yep. And Wisconsin is the highest at $224 million, while California at $141 million, and New York is the third highest. So, again, if there's any states lacking, it's in the southeastern states. They've received less than $10 million. Now, I know that's not dairy country, but
look at those numbers, Jim. $1 billion have only been paid to 17,000 producers.
Yeah.
The CFAP payments to dairy have been a lot larger than the other commodities.
Yeah.
On a per farm basis.
Totally. But our concern is more so, where is everyone else? Right. Where are the other 17,000 farmers, and why have they not applied?
Well, especially since they earlier said that they needed money for cash flow purposes. So
absolutely.
Know, so yeah, we'll have to ask Bill Northey that one into the coming week.
Indeed. And then also kind of an anomaly in this, or a surprise, that there's still, what, some $130 million left in the Small Business Administration programs.
$130 billion,
excuse me. You used the wrong letter there.
Yeah, we're into billions and trillions now, Jeff. When we were beat reporters, it was million.
And yeah, that's right. Yeah.
A lot, you know? Yeah, and there's going to be, although it was extended, what, until August 8th, I want to say, for sign-up, now there's going to be a debate on maybe we want to use some of this money for other purposes, and I think you're going to see that as under an ongoing debate. Perhaps use some of the funds to help schools reopen. You know, that's going to happen either way, whether it's come out of this funding or, you know, somewhere else. But yeah, both the House and Senate approved the extension for the PPP program this week.
Which, again, a reminder that farm operations and ag businesses are eligible for PPP. So if you've not done so yet, there is still, and I think surprised a lot of people, there is still money available in there. So talk to your banker if you have not yet made an application on that. Even though it is a loan, if you follow the guidelines, you can get that loan forgiven as well. So a very powerful program that you've got a few more days to get access to. So, Jim, let's talk about the debate over the next package. Of course, the House has passed the HEROES Act, which is a Democrat package that everyone says is going nowhere. But we're also running out of time. There's, what, about 10 days left in the July calendar, Jim, for Congress to take some action here?
Well, it's not going to happen in July, it looks like. The Senate's not back until July the 20th.
Right.
And so that's when the Senate says the Republicans in the Senate say they'll begin negotiations when they return July the 20th. They're not in any hurry on this next package. That doesn't mean it won't happen. High odds signal, 99%. You're going to have phase four of this aid program. They just want more information and more time to better target the needed aid. But agriculture is definitely going to be on the list for additional aid. That probably is going to happen very late July or before the August recess, John.
Yeah, and I guess, Annalisa, that timing really isn't concerning for agriculture at this point with the other programs that have been in place, is it?
No, I mean, I think that there's hog producers are still struggling to make up losses that they incurred in the spring and haven't been indemnified. Is that the right word, Jim?
Indemnified, yes.
Yeah, my words are hard today. but I think...
You're like five?
Exactly. But I think, you know, in terms of other producers, I think at this point we're past the hurdle where farmers will welcome the money, but it's not as much of a time crunch as it was a couple months ago, given that we've already received some payment.
But there would be a big push from farm country if something happens that I hope does not, and I don't expect it to, but you can't rule it out, is if these COVID-19 cases return to the meat processing sector. Then you've got an elevate of major hurt again for the livestock sector.
Yeah. Well, and also if the slow opening that we've seen for restaurants gets curtailed further. I mean, that is certainly, it's not a huge boost, but it is certainly helping sort out some of the problems that we've had in supply chains.
Definitely. And USDA this week did round two of their food, you know, the food package program, selected at least two new vendors. But that program is actually a little behind their goals. So that we're going to see the benefit of that continue as USDA gets, better staffed up relative to the outside vendors on that food aid program. That definitely helps the livestock sector.
Your point, John, we're starting to see this week some areas that are shutting restaurants back down. Phoenix is one example where they're not letting people dine in anymore. And the same in California. Governor Newsom has closed 19 counties to to in restaurant dining. And I mean, I think we saw as the opening up started that takeout just does not move anywhere near as much product as any of the other options.
Well, you know, here's something that I found out this week when it's been a while since I, got a Red Lobster meal. I like Red Lobster and I like the Admiral's Feast. And when I ordered it online to pick up, they said they, and I love their salads there, they're not offering salads because they don't have that much business, I guess, in order to keep the proper amount of lettuce. So that's an interesting one when you aggregate that, if additional restaurants are doing the same thing. So that jumped out at me this week.
Yeah, we've seen that here with a lot of restaurants kind of streamlining their menus. And I think it's actually been a good move for them that they've focused on what they can do well and have been doing it well, at least from what I've seen around here.
Agree. That's what you see out here too. And most of them that I've been to are all, I would not go inside to eat at any restaurant at this particular time, but there's a lot of outside venues here that it's just great eating out because with the spacing, as I've said before, you can actually hear the people that you're bringing to, and it's a far more relaxed atmosphere of some of these restaurants and bar areas outside.
Outside is definitely the key there. So Jim, you're saying August, September before we see something?
Not September, before the August recess. I think late July into the first week of August, but it's coming. I think the total package is going to be over the $1 trillion initially that the White House signaled and under the $3.5 trillion plus that the House Democrats have already approved. But there is more general support for the ag provisions in the House bill's language that expands the number of commodities that are eligible for payments. And recall also that now that we're in July, USDA Secretary Sonny Perdue has $14 billion of additional Commodity Credit Corporation funding that he can tap. That's above and beyond what additional funding that we get in phase four aid programs, John. So it's not going to be a lack of funding to help agriculture. The next program is going to be 2020 crop for COVID-related problems. And it could be a different system. Whether or not it's going to be based on historical plantings on the particular 2020 crop. Those issues, I don't think, have been settled at this particular time.
It brings up an interesting question, Jim. As we all know, we've discussed, the CFAP payments that are going out now are 80% of what the projected max payment is for any particular producer. They're holding back 20% to make sure that there's money to get something out to everyone. If they surpass 100% of the funding that's currently allocated for CFAP, can they tap into that $14 billion that's now available in CCC?
They haven't said that, but I would say yes, they can. But I think what they're finding out, John, is that in the case of corn and soybeans, they're not paying out as much as they initially thought at the beginning of the program. Now, I would surmise that perhaps that's because more farmers forward sold their 2019 crop, and i.e. they're not eligible for the payment because in USDA's eyes, they don't have any risk. I'm not going to get into that battle because I've got more than a few farmers and advisory services saying that they should take another look at that.
Yeah, I think Farm Bureau put out some maps today. I think the average corn payment across the nation was about $7,000 per producer. So that's lower than I would have guessed going into
With the big farmers and things like that. Yeah, so I think that there's going to be more money even available for the first round of CFAP due to that consideration of how they did the program, which they really should have based it on traditional plantings, historical plantings. I think that would have been a fairer approach rather than pick a date like a dartboard, January the 15th, and whether or not you still had, you know, owned inventory. I think that was a failed experiment.
Well, that's how they did it for near all commodities.
Sorry?
Livestock included. That's how it was set up for near all commodities, livestock included. And I agree with you. It's really interesting.
They're consistently wrong then.
but right, even those that had priced, though, had been that price was affected. So, I mean, they were exposed to the issues that affected those who didn't price.
Yeah. But, you know, some consultants for farmers have emailed me fervently with passion saying that if they advise the farmers to sell and yet later on they bought back on the board. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
They also have renewed risk. And I think that's a legitimate issue to discuss. But USDA does not see it that way. Once you lost ownership of that physical commodity, you had no risk. I can debate that. But, you know, it's much like the acreage report that we saw this week, a shocker for corn, especially. What I remember Conrad Leslie always told me, a farmer prognosticator of acreage and crop production from Illinois, he told me, you don't argue with the umpire. Okay, so what USDA said, that's going to be traded, and that's the case with the acreage.
Yeah, I do think that I wish we could get them to hear, and I'm not accusing Bill Northey of not listening, because I do think he's a good listener. But there's a solid argument to be made for promoting poor business practices by disqualifying those bushels. I mean, I definitely can understand that argument.
Well, at least USDA did the right thing, be balanced, I hope, in saying, okay, you producer groups, if you're not eligible in the initial round and you have data that you supply to us and can convince us, basically, we'll make the payments. And a number of groups, certain classes of wheat are doing that and other commodities. So, I think that is a fair process.
Indeed. Along with all the discussion about another round of COVID-19, I want to find out from you, Jim, if this gets tied into the COVID-19 assistance. And that is, yesterday the House passed an infrastructure bill. What are the prospects for that in the Senate? And does that discussion get wrapped into COVID-19 relief?
Very easy signal. Minor parts of it, but your major infrastructure reform bill is after the election issue in a new Congress and perhaps a new administration. But it's not necessarily a negative, because the plus on this, John, is that the House actually passed an infrastructure bill. So they showed that they had the votes. The Senate and the White House issued an OMB, Statement of Administration Policy, against the House bill. So that means that's not going to go anywhere. But we'll see if the Senate delivers on their version of a bill. So I don't want to get too negative. The signal I got from that is this issue is going to be eventually approved, just not this year. But there's a lot in there for agriculture, be it broadband, true broadband internet, high-speed internet aid to the farm states, and also our great waterway systems that need lots of funding for improvements and new aspects to our waterway system.
Is that the type of thing that could move in a lame duck session, or does it have to wait till new year?
It could move. I wouldn't rule it out. I would not rule it out. But depending on the makeup of what the new Congress will be, and if you had, it's just for debate, if you had the Democrats controlling the White House, House, and Senate, they're going to want to hold off until they are in control. So, I want to see the results. And I don't think that's a cop-out. I need to see the results of the election. Now, if it's split, if the Republicans retain control of the Senate, and even if the Democrats were to win the White House, then you could have a lame duck session. So that's a watch the results, sort of thing, to get our true signals.
All right. Other big news this week. We've had the back and forth all, well, for weeks now about the so-called gap waiver requests. These are a response to the court ruling that the EPA, the waiver requests from the renewable fuel standard were improper because they were supposed to be extensions. Well, these weren't extensions. They had big gap years where they didn't file for waivers. So now those oil companies are trying to come back, or those refiners trying to come back and say, hey, we need to get waivers for those years in between. So it is an extension. 52 waivers now sitting at EPA for consideration. But the big news this week, Jim, is now EPA Administrator Wheeler says even he has some questions about these gap year waiver requests.
He had several questions, and that tells me later rather than sooner. Now, the rumor today, okay, was that it's indefinitely, these decisions have been indefinitely postponed. Now, remember, for the new mandates for the year ahead, there's a no later than November 30th that they have to announce that. Now, one of my best sources in the RFS area, when I ask him, do you think the possibility is that they'll wait until after November 3rd elections under these sensitive issues? And this particular person emailed me back, is that from a legitimate source? What he has heard is that Wheeler is upset, he used a different word, that Senator Ernst first put a hold on Benevento. Then Cruz, Senator Cruz responded in turn based on oil's concern over Ernst Hold. And he had not yet heard until after November the 3rd and was asking me who I'm hearing that from. Well, I can't tell him sources. He should know that. But then he ended with the renewable fuel standard. I'm now fond of saying every action has an equal or greater reaction. Newton's third law. So this is an unfolding thing, but I'll tell you, the signal I'm getting is Wheeler knows, EPA Administrator Andrew Wheeler, he knows the political ramifications of this if he were to do anything that's considered negative relative to the waiver issue in farm country, because Trump cannot lose Iowa, and he can't lose Senator Ernst either. This is how significant that is. And that's the signal I'm getting out of this. We could get a delay in this issue. And they'll punt it off on Department of Energy, as I think he did yesterday, Wheeler. We haven't received their recommendations. It's still under review. So that to me is a signal of punting for right now.
For right now. But if this does become a big political hot potato, that could bring it to the front burner very quickly, couldn't it?
Well, I think they are going to try to delay, but then the issue will be.
Well, but if it looks like it's going to cost him votes in the election, then he's not going to delay.
Then he won't delay. But Senator Chuck Grassley and Ernst and others will press the White House to have EPA, you know, make a decision. Tell us how you're going to follow or not follow the law is what they'll probably say.
Indeed. And Annalisa, we're, you know, every time this has come up, we've seen the pressure ramp up on this from corn country.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Jim said it, you know, farmers would like to see the administration and the EPA follow the law. And that's the end of it.
Yeah, indeed. I think it makes everyone other than the oil company scratch their heads when you look at, oh, we're going to come back and fill in those years. That just... Yeah, it would be interesting to see if the court even agrees with that strategy.
It defies logic, but it's not the first time the EPA has defied logic.
Yeah.
Well, and then when Senator Cruz entering in saying that he wants a relief for the RIN prices, you know, as Chip Flory always says on AgriTalk, just let the system work and the RINs should take care of themselves from a market aspect. Yeah, they might go higher, they might go lower, but at least the systems works.
Yeah, they weren't complaining all those years that they were low.
What always makes me laugh about that is that Senator Cruz claims to be a free market person, but not when it comes to RINs.
That's called Congress.
All right. Well, let's also talk a little bit about we had a bullish acreage and stocks report this week from USDA. Corn acreage in particular below what the projections were. Soybean stocks down sharply. So Jim, some markets were after 2 days up, backed off a little bit today, but really some much needed good market news.
Oh, absolutely. And now it's just going to amplify any weather concerns if you have them. There's a potential ridge building. The key there will be where at and how long does it last. But I'll tell you, many veteran industry analysts told me they were baffled by the acreage report, especially as it pertained to both corn and soybeans, because they said this, if you exclude the 1983 pick year, payment in kind year, which you probably should, this would be a record difference between changes from the March prospective plantings and the June acreage report. But remember what I said before, that don't argue with the umpire. NAS, USDA's NAS will always say, this is what the survey numbers showed. So were the March planting intentions too high? That was a possibility. But those same industry analysts I talked about earlier say, you know, the reduction from the prospective plantings for the 16 principal crops were down 6.6 million acres and 7.4 million acres from 2018. You know, it's better to compare it to 2018 rather than the year that we saw in 2019. And they're telling me it's hard to explain why farmers cut so many acres this year, given their historical plantings. And some to many farmers I've talked to probably thought that they may have to plant 2020 crops in order to get a possible additional COVID or China-related payment ahead. So isn't that interesting? So there's there's question marks, but it is what it is. And now weather, you look to the skies for the direction for corn and soybeans. Plus, we're still going to have plenty of beans. Corn for the 2021 season, right around 2.7 billion bushels. So this is not a bull market. It's still, from all intents and purposes, a sell the rally market.
Yeah, it's certainly anticipating still a big crop. And I get everything you said, Jim, but Annalisa, on the flip side, it is an indication that the market's working, that lower prices held back acres.
Yeah, I mean, if you take the numbers for what they were, which, as Jim said, is what we have to do at this point, because the report's been made and that's, you know, what USDA is saying our acres are. I do always wonder about survey responses and how many of those surveys came back, particularly in a year like this when we were trying, you know, to squeeze in field work in the last few months in between rains and dry spots and other things. I do always wonder about that.
But that, you know, in the past, when NAS has thought that, they would do more follow-on telephone surveys.
Yes, and they would note it in their notes, which they did not do this time, but we did receive a reminder today about encouraging farmers to report their acreage
certification. But that's a macro key in FSA offices that each year. You know, I did go back, and there was a Bloomberg, Megan from Pro Farmer's office, recalled, and it was interesting one, that the Bloomberg filed a report before, like it was last month, the drop in fertilizer prices that said at the time could suggest lighter corn plantings than anticipated. This was a month ago. Spot prices for ammonia and urea in the U.S. Gulf are trading near two-year lows amid a drop in industrial demand and an increase in Chinese production. But the Bloomberg intelligence analyst, they said at the time, said the situation could also suggest U.S. producers sold fewer acres than the 97 million USDA projected in March. That seems to be the consensus. A big crop, not as big as USDA projected. So I will give credit to that analyst. Maybe he was right.
But those acres didn't go in the soybeans, so where did they go, I think, is the question, right?
That's true. Well, that's when you aggregate those principal crops. And what veteran analysts told me, the March planting intentions was a better fit to an analyst, to an economist who likes everything to like a puzzle, but this one didn't. So they're thinking that come the October report, when we have Farm Service Agency certification reports that NASS uses, the first use in the October report, this crowd thinks that we could see eventually higher acreage numbers, but let the debate continue.
Yeah,
and that debate rages on every year, and everyone likes to debate whether or not NASS has the number right. But let's face it, when you go back and look at history, NASS is usually pretty close, and for a couple of reasons, from my view. One is they're working with a bigger, more direct data set than anybody else.
Yes.
Number two, they don't have skin in the game. They have no emotion. They can't be pulled emotionally in this because they are just looking at the data and have been manipulating the data in the same way for decades.
They're statisticians, and like they always tell me, this is what the survey says. And they have some room, John, in which to go
right
on like a ruler, a little higher or a little lower and things like that. And there were some reports that maybe they had some inside information, or I shouldn't say inside information, unannounced information relative to prevent plant and things like that. I have not confirmed that. I think that if they did use that information, they would have put it in the body of the acreage report.
Yes.
Because NASS usually does that. So no, I just think this is what they, what the survey showed.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's fun, to debate. It's more fun to debate USDA than it is to debate the weather. And it's also easy when you don't fully understand, which I would argue that most farmers do not fully understand the entire process of how the June acreage report is conducted. And put together, it's easy to speculate that it's wrong because you don't understand it. That's just
and especially nature. You'll attack it if you, as a private analyst, were wrong.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, and there's so much assigning of motives on these reports, and there are no motives in these reports. As you said, it's what the data reflects.
Absolutely.
Now, whether there was a flaw in how the data was collected, okay, maybe, but again, they've been perfecting this for decades, so I'm pretty well convinced that they're going to do it as well as anybody.
Notice, John, that without what the two-day price rise, that there weren't any calls for investigations?
Yeah, no, see, people seem to be all right with the numbers this time. It wasn't like last summer at all.
You investigation with lower prices.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. The bottom line is NASS tends to know what they're doing.
NASS, it's hard to defend myself, let alone government agencies, but I've covered NASS for over four decades, and they don't have an agenda. It's what the numbers show, whether they're right or wrong.
Wrong. It's what the numbers is.
The June acreage report per the final, there's not much difference over the years, so history is on their side.
Well, and I think it's also important to point out that the intentions report may have been right for when it was put out and different from the acreage report and different from the final crop report. Those are all just snapshots in time. So that story changes throughout the growing season. So even though prospective plantings and the final number may not match up, they were correct at the time they were collected.
Agreed.
All right. So is it time for the lightning round, Jim?
I think it is.
All right, let's hit it. We started last week, or 2 weeks ago, I guess it was. We skipped a week. Jim Wiesmar is going to take on the lightning round on Lisa. Feel free to jump in on these. First one, is there any signal to American Soybean Association, their CEO, leaving after just 2 years in the job, Jim?
I think there's a signal. We just don't know what it is right now. There's some conjecture in this town that maybe this is a signal that Deputy USDA Secretary Steve Sinski could be heading back to his old job. I did not call Steve because I don't want to put him on the spot. I'm not even checking on this. But, it makes sense logically, doesn't it? Because Steve was a very popular CEO there. But anytime you're in a CEO position for only 2 years, there's something going on there.
Yeah, and let's face it, Steve was very hard to replace there. He is, the name of the CEO who just left, his name is escaping me at the moment. But Steve was in that job for a long time, very influential in that job, did a very good job there. And I think soy growers would welcome him back if that were the case.
Well, and a plus for the ASA over the last year is that they changed their Washington office from really a consulting group, used to be John Gordley for many years, private consultant, to now ASA employees. And Christy Seifert, who I know quite well, is an excellent person to head any Washington office. So I applaud the American Soybean Association for getting their own people in there, and especially Christy Seifert, who in this town, if you want a bipartisan person that will work her butt off, it's Christy. So I applaud them for it. And the outgoing CEO helped that happen. So that's a plus for him.
There you go. All right. Question two. Any presidential polls catching your attention, Jim?
The one I saw, can't remember what exactly, it was a named poll, but they had Missouri going for Biden. That's why
By one.
Yeah, that's why I suspect polls now. I just don't like, I'll guarantee you Missouri will vote for Trump, okay? So this has got me saying, nope, I'm not going to believe the polls until very closer to the actual election. So and only believe state polls anyway. But even this one was, I just think it's a signal to me that don't quote pollsters for a while.
Well, your disdain for polls is well documented, Jim. We are all on the same page that you think most polls are trash.
Yeah, I agree. And I always ask people when I go, when we used to go out for speeches and have hundreds of people, have you ever been called by one of these pollsters? And I've never said they were called. So I'm still after my first person.
Oh, I've been called, Jim. I've been called.
Interesting.
Yeah, but then as soon as you tell them, you know, they ask if you work for media, you say yes and okay, goodbye. But I have been called.
I'll put an asterisk. Okay.
But you're right. We're 4 months out. So anything could change between now and then.
Well, look at what at the beginning of the year, Trump was going to win in a landslide because of the economy, the unemployment rate low. And then look what happened.
Right. Okay. And that's my point, is that there's a lot of landscape to cover between now and then. But, you know, and even if these polls aren't right with the what the spread is, I think the message, the signal we can take away with is that Donald Trump is not in the position where he needs to be at this point in the election cycle.
There is no doubt about that. Trump, the biggest, I think, fault, well, his tone needs to be better on a number of issues. But two, he better start saying why he wants a second term, because he will not be elected based on past economic and regulatory and judicial issues. He's got to tell the American people, voters, of why he wants another 4 years. And to date, he has not yet done that.
Well, and the plan for getting past the pandemic, not only for dealing with the issues of the pandemic and getting it contained, but then also how we recover America out of this pandemic. All right. Next lightning round question. Is COVID still impacting the meetings that you usually attend?
Almost all of them. American Sugar Alliance this week canceled their usually August meeting. First time I've been going to them for decades. But there's one, Wisconsin Farm Credit called me last week. And unless they change in the middle of August, they have a fly-to event in Wisconsin near the Wisconsin Dells. That's the first one I've seen for a while. Now I need to find out how many people are going to be there, but I did order a respirator from Canada, by the way, a really good specced out respirator.
Really?
Yeah. So if I travel, I'm going to have the best equipment that I can find.
All right. Well, come prepared. You are a Boy Scout, Jim. Last week on AgriTalk, Jim, you said you were in a bad mood. Anything improving?
A number of emails came in, Chip Flory told on the air. Why did I feel that way? You know, about three times a year, I'm always usually bubbly optimistic. And there's about two or three times a year at the most, even with COVID, that I'll get down. It was the potpourri of negatives, and I don't think I have to tell you, in the country, with the retrenchment under the certain states, Texas, Florida, et cetera. Here we go again, closed down but not out. You had the stock market going down. You had just all these statue issues that I'm a history major in college, believe it or not. And I, you know, yes, there's issues, but put them in museums, you know, educate people. So we were really going the wrong way under a host of issues. You had the Seattle situation that now we're finding that once you start demonstrating at the mayor's house in Seattle, you get a different interpretation of what needs to be done. So it's just an element of every once in a while, it's not just getting off on the wrong side of the bed. It's just you should have stayed in bed that day.
I also found out that you don't protest at the house of the mayor of St. Louis either.
No, and that's just a way our neighbors of it, because
right, exactly.
Not a nice house, by the way.
Yes,
I protected it.
Yeah, you and I have been in that neighborhood. We know what that neighborhood's like.
Forest Park area, absolutely.
Yeah, I'd offer too, if anybody is listening that hasn't listened to last Friday's episode of AgriTalk in the morning, the AM show, Jim, I really appreciated and respected how you and Pam disagreed wholeheartedly on a couple of issues and were able to talk about them in a nuanced way that was productive and not just disagreement. So I would encourage them to go listen to that.
Pam's a good corn producer from Iowa. We just choose to disagree on a number of issues, but we agree on more than people realize, called market-oriented policy. So yes, definitely. Yeah. That's why the AgriTalk group is so much fun to work with.
Yeah, indeed. And I'm going to take this opportunity here. I know we talked about that Chip and I talked about this on AgriTalk several weeks ago, but I want to say something here as well, now that you mentioned it, Jim, in that we do get a lot of pushback on having Pam on that show. And it's not going to change. I wholeheartedly support having Pam on the show. I know you do too. Yeah. Even though, like you said, you often disagree with her. A lot of people often disagree with her, but that's why we have her on. She presents a different perspective in a very respectful, very thoughtful way that gives us all pause to think a little differently than we might have without her input. That doesn't mean that someone's going to suddenly change and disagree and switch parties, whatever. But without that discussion, your position, Jim, my position, your position on Lisa is less informed. If you don't hear from the other side, your position is less informed and is going to be less impactful than if you listen to the other side and hear their perspective.
Totally agree. I remember in the early days of Pro Farmer Newsletter, before the internet, before electronics, everything, Merrill Oster, as one of the founders and owners, would come into us on Thursday and look at the Outlook pages and say, okay, write it as if you had the opposite position.
Mm-hmm.
That was humbling, and it taught me you can find facts and figures to support any particular topic.
Yep.
You know, but you need to hear both to have the best. And that's what Pam brings to, plus her industry connections and that she goes to groups. She's a very good trade policy person, and that's what she brings to the show.
Indeed. Annalisa, were you going to jump in there?
Yeah, I was just going to add, you know, it's not without practice that we are able to listen to somebody we disagree with and hear them. And I think it's really, like, we talk about this a lot on our news team of reading different sources and different perspectives and investigating things from all angles, because that's what journalists do, believe it or not. But I think even just as Americans, to have a true opinion about something, you have to have heard the other person's perspective. And I'm thankful that Pam provides that.
Absolutely. And that's why over the last several administrations, when both Democrat and Republican presidents were very down on lobbyists. I was taught my entire career and saw it, not only taught, but lived it, that lobbyists are very much experts in their industry. Yes, they're slanted, but they'll give you some pertinent facts and figures on which you can help decide as a writer, journalist, analyst, an issue. Again, sounding all sides out on an issue.
Indeed. Indeed. And hey, we want to hear from you. If you disagree with us, drop us an email at signaltonoise@farmjournal.com. That's all spelled out, signaltonoise@farmjournal.com. We'd love to hear from you what you think. Even if you agree with us, we'd love to hear from you on that. All right, Jim, where are you watching for signal this week?
Well, China, to see whether this rat-a-tat-tat is back at us again. Let's hope it doesn't go the more negative route that will negatively impact phase one, right when we're going into the gut slot of normal purchases. And two, now that we have the acreage report passed, it's time to look to the skies. It's going to be weather-oriented for the next few months.
All right, Annalisa.
Watching dairy markets, as Jim mentioned briefly, the USDA did award some new contracts and pour some more money into the Farmers to Families Food Box Program. And I mean, I'm not going to say that cheese prices can't go higher than what they have been recently, but it'll be really interesting to see.
All right, we'll be keeping our eyes open. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. Don't forget, if you're listening to this podcast, you can now see our lovely faces as well. If you want, go to agweb.com and look for the Signal to Noise story. We've got a video of all of us talking up here on the podcast, so go check that out. Thanks for joining us. For Jim Wiesmeyer, for Annalisa Laca, I'm John Harith. Thanks for joining us on DC Signal to Noise.